You know, often say student outcomes don't change until adult behaviors change. Like the transformation has to start with us.
Welcome to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I'm your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branching Minds team, here to lead conversations with educational leaders and experts. My hope is to share with you not only valuable insights and knowledge from leaders in education, but have fun while doing it and shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. One of the greatest influences on transforming education is the decisions of the adults. Will they choose to maintain the status quo or find a better way? Our guest today is an advocate for taking risks to find a better way to improve schools and support students. AJA Crable believes that student outcomes don't change until adult behaviors change. In my conversation with AJA, we talk not only about his work in helping improve schools, but also his work in helping schools create student-led restorative circles. Restorative practices focus on resolving conflict, repairing harm, and healing relationships. It really is an overarching term to refer to strategies that help build community in ways that treat humans with dignity and respect. AJ also serves as a conservator at DeSoto ISD in Texas and as the governance director for the Council of Great City Schools. He's served as a deputy commissioner for the Texas of Education Agency and as a board chair for the Kansas City Public Schools. Although he says he most enjoys working with students and faculty in establishing restorative practices within a school. Here is my conversation with AJ. Today on our podcast, we are excited to welcome AJ Crable, who is a coach, author, speaker, teacher, so many other things that describe you, but I'll let you kind of introduce yourself a little bit. I know I use more words than you did, but.
Oh, I've just been blessed by public education and get to spend all day, every day trying to figure out how to make sure that blessing gets passed on to the next generation of our children.
So I know that you have a lot of different things that you're currently doing, but I would love to hear maybe what part of your current roles or even just everyday tasks that you're the most excited about that you're doing and, or the work that you're the most excited about currently.
Oh, that's easy. Right now I'm working with 4 high schools in one district to deploy student-led restorative practices. And so let me break those two pieces down. There's the student-led and there's restorative practices. The restorative practices first. The default template for behavior and discipline across the country is retributive practices. We figure out what little AJ did, and then we identify the appropriate retribution to mete out for that. The challenge with that is it doesn't actually meet the standard of really helping students learn from the choices they make. What we really want schools to be great at is helping students learn how to think critically, how to collaborate effectively, how to essentially be an effective adult, one who can live out their aspirations and who can really succeed on their own terms and in the world around them and be able to take care of themselves and their family. But simply having students never learn to be responsible, to be fully accountable for their actions, doesn't actually get us there. Schools are intended to be places of learning. And if little AJ flunks the math test, then what would you recommend we do about that?
Yeah. Well, you would probably spend some time helping him understand what he needs to understand to be able to pass the math test.
You do some reteaching. This is you kind of do some analysis about, you know, why is it that you flunk a math test, and you do some reteaching. But then eventually we get around to, you know, with my hard work as a teacher, little AJ, and your hard work, you know, as a student, you know, we're going to get you up to where you need to be on this math test. And eventually there's going to be another math test on down the road, and little AJ is going to get a chance to take it. And that's what we call school. And all I'm suggesting is behavior should be treated similar to how we treat math. And at some point, little AJ is definitely going to flunk that behavior quiz. Full-scale flunkage. But then in the context of that, what is our response? And all I'm saying is, I like the response you came up with. Let's do some analysis around why little AJ didn't pass the behavior quiz. Let's do some reteaching. Let's create the context in which little AJ has to be fully accountable for repairing whatever harm his choices have created. That's part of the reteaching process when it comes to behavior, is that I've got to accept responsibility for my behavior. And part of that is repairing the harm, is whatever mess I've made, I got to clean up the mess. And then upon doing all of those things, little AJ, with your hard work and my guidance, the next time we have a behavior quiz, our plan is that you're going to pass this thing with flying colors. Like, this is what I mean when I say restorative practices, that the intentionality is that when students make mistakes, not if, like, raise your hand if you've never made a mistake in life. I mean, the nature of school is that we make mistakes, but then the joy in that is there is a group of adults surrounding you, helping you figure out, how do we learn from that? How do we take responsibility for the mistakes that I've made? And how do I repair whatever harm and do whatever work is necessary to get to the next level of learning? This is what I see as the distinction between restorative practices and the standard template for discipline and behavior management in schools, which is retributive practices. I'm focused on what can there be learned from taking full accountability, full responsibility for your behaviors and repairing the harm, as opposed to how quickly can we suspend little AJ, knowing full well that 5 days spent at home are probably not going to be spent in meditative contemplation about my behavior and how I can take responsibility. Rather, this is going to be a great opportunity to get caught up. I'm a little bit behind, on Call of Duty. I got to level up my character a little bit on Fortnite. I don't understand how that's the solution. So that's the restorative practices part, but the really important part is also the student-led part. Is I'm a strong believer in trying to figure out how much agency can we put in the hands of our students as part of their education, that as they are more engaged in their education, as they take more ownership, more responsibility for their education, in my mind, positive things come out of that. I think of myself and other people I've known that when we're fired up about something, we're going to learn it. We're going to dive in with both hands and grab it. And you'd be hard pressed to prevent us from learning in that context. In the context of me owning my own learning, I don't know how you would stop me from learning something. And we see this all the time with young people who get super fired up about engines and taking everybody's car and lawnmower apart, and they're slowly figuring out how to put it back together. We get super excited about writing, and they're writing all day, every day, and these novel lengths. When young people get fired up, just like when you and I get fired up, is we treat it differently. So this idea of student-led restorative practices says, what would it be like if we entrusted with our students the accountability for being the first tier of intervention when little AJ inevitably makes a poor decision? Instead of sending that off to an assistant principal, can we train a group of students and they be the first to learn? And if they can't lead that through the process and get it to a place that works, they can always escalate that onto the adults and can go through the normal process. And so that's what I mean by student-led restorative practices. And I love the work that I do with school districts and superintendents and school boards. I love the work that I do with principals, but few things I'm enjoying more right now than the work I get to do with teachers and students around helping these four high schools deploy student-led restorative practices. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit longer of an answer than you probably will expect.
No, because it kind of leads into, I wanted to really discuss with you the restorative practices piece, but kind of on a bigger level, I'm curious about when you do this kind of work, that's a way different approach than many educators are trained in. Maybe even just like the system that, we both probably experienced growing up, that's very different. How do you approach that with district leadership or even school leadership in in shaping this kind of restorative practice initiative within a school? I mean, like, what would be the, what happens to bring that in?
Well, I don't know. That's not a part of the equation.
You're just invited in to be part of the, okay.
Exactly. Like, I don't show up and try to convince people that we should trust students and extend autonomy to them in their own learning processes. I don't show up and try to convince people that a restorative approach to building leadership might get us different results than a retributive approach. Like that's not my thing. I don't have time for that. And so as people hear about the work that we're doing,
so you're invited in.
People reach out and post, happy to show up and support folks. And in fact, even the district I'm working in, they've got a lot of high schools. And the initial is like, hey, Jay, will you help us deploy this in all of our high schools? I'm like, absolutely not. Well, what I'll do is we can deploy it in just a few to pilot it and really tweak it, make it yours so it uniquely belongs to you all with just a few schools, a coalition of the most willing, the most ready. And then, as you all desire, you can expand it to the other schools. And so that's what we're doing. We've got a two-year pilot with just four of their high schools. And at the end of that 2 years, ideally, they will have performed well enough on my implementation rubric that they'll have really solidified it in those four schools, and then they'll be in a position to expand it. Now, what's interesting is as we've gotten deeper and deeper into this work, not only are there other high schools who's like, ooh, pick me, but now some of the middle schools are like, oh, no, hold up now. How can we get on this? Like, we need some of this love for our middle school. Like, how are we going to make this happen? And so I suspect that as long as this is implemented effectively and it shows results for students, there'll be a lengthy line of folks waiting to get in. But that's how it should be. This is not work that is given to being forced upon people. You can't force people to be transformed. Have to choose that journey for themselves. And that's why I wouldn't do it with all of the schools. Sometimes not all of them are ready. We put out an application and said, let's have people apply and have it be a really annoying and difficult process just to see who's willing to go through it. Yeah, to who wants it most? And then let's dig in with those folks and let's build it there. Let's build it the right way, slowly, intentionally, methodically. And then once we've really demonstrated this can produce results for children in these schools, then open the doors to expansion elsewhere.
Well, and I think that's key for, you know, lack of a better term, but buy-in, right? Like it to see the work that's being done and seeing the effectiveness of it and how that can change the culture of a school. I mean, that's social proof, right? Like that's like, oh, I see what they're doing. Now I want more. I want to be part of that. And I think that's so important for, you know, that transformation work. And I like what you said, like you can't force people to be like, you know, transformed in their way of thinking, because I mean, the reason I think I see how your approach may be more effective, because when you're like, you say to a district, hey, we're going to try this whole new thing that no one's really used to yet and just do it, you know, like a mandated approach feels a lot like that's when things are not going to be as effective.
Not a great plan.
So with that and your restorative practices work, like how, can you maybe come up with like, I mean, what keeps you motivated in doing this kind of work? Cause clearly like you are extremely passionate about it, but like what motivates you to keep working with schools in this way?
Well, a lot of this, like I said earlier, this is about me passing on an opportunity that I had the privilege of being the recipient of. Like I was the most hard-headed student you have probably ever encountered on this show. And so the reality is there's some teachers who sliced through a lot of foolishness that I put out on the table. It's like, yeah, we're not accepting that. Like there is more within you. And we're going to push for that. We're going to push for what's possible for you, even when you don't fully see what's possible for you. And it was that insistence on fully exposing the potential within me with the part of the teachers that I experienced. Like, that is amazing, amazing, powerful work. And I am forever indebted, you know, to these hardworking public school teachers who made that difference for me. And so it's super easy to be fired up about trying to stand in the pathway of the next generation of little AJs who may not have yet fully embraced their own power, their own capacity, their own hopes and dreams, that we could create a pathway that would allow them to stand in their own greatness. Like, that's super easy to get fired up about.
I totally understand that. I think that that is, you know, we can all remember those teachers that sort of believed in us in a moment when we didn't believe in ourselves, or even just like saw the potential for more. Yeah. Because often I taught middle school for many years, and I often thought that middle school students really couldn't, it has to do with their brain development, of their ability to see past their own sort of like perspective and blinders. And so when you can kind of get in there and help them see a bigger picture, even just say, hey, you have way more potential than you even understand in this moment. And you kind of have to carry your belief as the teacher has to kind of carry them through some of those difficult moments.
Awkward moments.
awkward moments. So I'm curious, in some of this work that you're doing, like what kind of, how do you approach in those moments of like, even within a school that's really excited about the work and they're like all aboard, I'm sure that there's like barriers that you encounter in some of this implementation. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach some of those barriers, or even what some of those barriers that, like, even the school with the best intentions?
Well, part of the challenge, of course, is time. You have to create the context where the adults in the building have an understanding of what's happening so that they're best positioned to support the students in this work. So on a 2-year implementation timeline for this pilot, I spent the first 9 months, every single month holding trainings. The first 9 months, explicitly and only exclusively training adults. So remember, this is student-led restorative practices. Spent the first 9 months of a 24-month process only training adults. That's because I've not seen little AJ ever destroy a restorative practices process. I've just not seen that. Like, I've never seen, like, oh man, little AJ is so bad, he has broken our intentions around restoration. Like, that's not real. What I do see, however, is haphazardly implemented, haphazardly thought through and planned out processes that wind up landing on top of our educators, and that they don't see how this is helping them help children be great. They don't see how this is helping them be effective as educators in the classrooms, and so they just opt out. And so if you don't take the time to provide the training, provide the opportunity to get all the questions answered and really create this deep space of clarity for educators, this will just feel like something, the flavor of the day that's happening to them, not something that they experience as an opportunity that they can pull toward themselves. It's really going to help them be great on behalf of the students they serve. And so it's always the challenge. You know, there's a reason that I often say student outcomes don't change until adult behaviors change. Like, mm-hmm. like the transformation has to start with us. And the other challenge is actually speaking on student autonomy and agency at a conference this weekend. And somebody asked me almost the same questions, like, what's one of the big things that holds this stuff back? And when I reflected on it for a while, I came back to it and said, don't expect adults to provide for children that which is not going to be provided for them. Don't expect on a long-term basis that adults are going to create a restorative, safe space for students when they are dealing with a toxic work environment day in and day out. And so if you really want to give this work longevity, you've got to create a great workspace, a restorative workspace for adults, that adults need to have the same space to try things on behalf of children and to screw it up, to royally screw it up, but then to have an opportunity to be fully accountable for their choices, not to be beaten over the head for it, but to certainly be accountable for repairing whatever harm they've created and moving forward. I would rather have educators swing and miss than never leave the dugout and stay in the safety of the dugout, watching children fail, watching children wander in the wilderness. But it's safer for me over here. If I don't swing, I can't strike out, so I'm just going to stay over here. Like, that's not the space. That's not why people got in the profession. to just kind of sit in the dugout and watch and hope it works out well for kids. People got in the ink because they want to take a swing at it, but if we create a toxic work environment for teachers, then we're incentivizing them to sit this one out. And when that happens, the idea of student-led restorative practices dies a quiet death. And so that's one of the challenges, I would say, is that we can't try to create this amazing transformative environment for our students if we're not also willing to make sure that we've extended the benefits of that to our staff as well.
Yeah. Oh, I think that that's so true. And, something we've talked about on this podcast before, and just even in my conversation with many educators, that, all that teachers experiencing with burnout and with just being at their limits and capacity wise in the last few years has really sort of shined this light, this need for teachers to be, the work environment. And that's why they say that, the culture of the school really impacts the effectiveness of programs and instructional in curriculum and any of that stuff. If you don't have a supportive environment for teachers, if they don't feel like they belong, just as kids, right? They don't feel like they belong or they're belonging safe. Belonging matters. And I just think that that is huge to think about on the adult level as well as the kid level. And I think it starts, right? If you don't have a happy teacher, it's not going to be a happy classroom, right? Like if your teacher is not, feel so safe, it's hard for them to create a safe space for students. I think that you're right in that. And I also would say too, I'm sure that that work with adults, because there's probably a lot of undoing that has to be done in that work with adults to get them to the place of creating that safe space or just even being ready to work with kids or being open to this new way of, with restoration. So, I definitely agree with that. You've done work at the school board level, at the district level, and even, now with students. And I can definitely see that, I always say that the most fun, the part that I miss most about teaching is the students, right? And the relationships with them. But I know that you have a new book coming out about school governance and just all of those things. Do you want to talk a little bit about this book and just some of your work around school boards and change from there?
Yeah, the intention of the book is how can we help school boards live into their aspirations for children in the most powerful way. But the default template for school board service across our 14,000 school boards is a mindset that is actually robbing school boards of our capacity to be great on behalf of the children that we serve. That inside of a mindset that's intensely focused on what are the adults' preferences, what are the adults wanting? What are the things that are concerning adults today? What are the things that make adults happy? And inside of this intense focus on the inputs of the system that the adults are involved in, often school boards never pivot from that and invest any of their time on, okay, what are the results of all of this? Has any of all of this work that the adults have put in, has it created something powerful in the lives of our children? Has it caused improvements in what they know we're able to do? School systems only exist to improve student outcomes. It's the only reason school systems exist. School systems don't exist, to provide jobs in the county. They don't exist to have great stadiums or great books. They don't exist to have happy parents. And they don't exist to have employed teachers. All those things are great. They don't exist to have balanced budget. Those are great. All of these adult inputs are valuable. I'm not suggesting they're not. I'm just saying that's not why school systems exist. And so when boards spend all of their time focused on the adult inputs to the exclusion of really investing time into, are children actually learning? Are the outcomes for students, or is what students know and are able to do actually improving? School boards that focus all their time on adult inputs to the exclusion of a focus on student outcomes, school boards that set their children up to fail. And this is not what's in the heart of school board members. This is not why people get on the school board, but this is what school board members do. And the intention of this book is to just show that there's another way, that instead of being intensely focused on adult inputs, that The intention of the book is to be a guide to help school board members become intensely focused instead on improving student outcomes.
Yeah. I like what, I like that you said that, you know, student outcomes don't change until adult behaviors do. Do you have, I mean, I'm sure that you have lots of examples and things like that.
The book is full of them.
The book is full of them.
And just to be fair, just so people know, all the stories in the book are sadly quite true, but all the names have been changed to protect the guilty. I don't call anybody out, but I have received an inordinate number of calls lately, like, hey, AJ, chapter 3, is that my board? It's like, hey, look, we don't name names here. We don't name names. You just gonna have to, you know, gonna have to kind of just, you know, cogitate on that a little bit. If you see yourself, well, then maybe that's the Lord trying to say something to you about your life. but a lot of stories about that.
I guess what I'm curious what you would say to, you know, whether it be superintendents or district level admin that like are trying to work with school boards, because, you know, there's just things sometimes out of our control as educators, right? Cause we, you know, we aren't the ultimate decision makers really. You know, we have a lot of influence in that, but do you have like encouragement or advice to those that are working with their school boards or like things that they can do to help like foster that positive relationship or anything like that?
Yeah, well, and this book was partly written for them as well. This book, you know, I really think of a love letter to all of our parent leaders, our teacher leaders, but as well as our administrators and our school board members, our community leaders who really want to stand up for school boards and help them be great on behalf of the students they serve. And so, yeah, this idea that there's something in there for them as well, most definitely. In fact, there's whole chunks that are specifically called out. By the way, for the superintendents reading this, here's something for you. Make sure you do not miss this section because you know, they're in the same position that they really, they got into the profession to make a difference. But there's not a lot of superintendent preparation programming that I see out here that is really helping superintendents have clarity around what is it they can do to most set the school boards up for success. So in fact, what I see in most superintendent prep, and yeah, I'm gonna call it out, is here are the practices that will help put your school board in a box so that they will do no harm. And I understand why people get there. I understand it. I'm not knocking it. I'm not faulting folks. I am saying you are leaving points on the boards for children when you behave this way. Instead of helping school boards be great, helping school boards be contained means that the extra additional benefit that school boards could in fact be offering to the organization are foregone. They're foregone in favor of the safety of not having them muck things up. There's a risk you take when you actually support boards in governing effectively. There's amount of control that you give up when you support boards governing effectively. And so I understand why superintendents do it. I'm not heaping blame on them. I'm just saying the cost to that behavior, the cost to playing it safe and putting school boards in a box, is that there's an incremental amount of benefit, an incremental amount of value, an incremental amount of improvement in student outcomes that could be gained from a school system actually working, like, you know, going on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. And moreover, the children who are most harmed by that lack of that additional increment are your children who are already furthest from educational justice. You know, our children who already have the resources and supports they need, when they don't get that little added oomph out of the school system, they already have safety nets. They're going to buoy them up. They're going to be okay. It's the little AJs of our communities for whom public schools were the last safety net that they were relying on. That when the holes in the net are too large, that they slip through, there's nothing going to be beneath them. And so we have to weave that net as tightly as possible so they won't fall through it. But this is a challenge when we treat boards like they're on the sideline, we put them in a box and try to contain them so that they do no harm. What we're also doing is we're expanding the gaps in the safety net. I understand why superintendents do this. I get it. I'm just saying there's another way. And my intention with the book is to help highlight what that might look like.
Yeah. Oh man. I when you said about the last safety net for certain students, I think that is how public schools are that. I think that's really powerful to kind of think about in a way, is that, you know, when I have those students that would come to school and this was their safe place, right? This was where they got the hot meal. This is where they, you know, had access to certain, you know, like access to a nurse and certain like supplies and things like that. And I just think that often times decisions are made in boardrooms and things like that. And it the further away people are from those students, sometimes like they become data and statistics, but we forget those stories in our brain. And, I'm a big believer in the power of stories. And so like, I just wanted to highlight that comment, 'cause I thought that is really key for those decision makers to not forget those stories about the students who need that public school safety net, and that safe place to be.
Not enough to not forget the stories. You actually have to constantly refreshing the stories. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things, you know, we certainly do in my district right now, but the part of the coaching model in the book is to encourage boards across the country to do, is we monitor progress relative to our goals every single month without fail. We pull out our goals, we look at our progress measure and figure out, are we moving the needle in the direction of students knowing and being able to do the things that we intend for them as a community? Are we getting closer and closer to our aspirations for our children? But part of that monitoring is whichever group of students have most demonstrated growth, not proficiency, growth in the direction of that in the last month, we bring them forward and we honor them and we praise them and we lift them up and we, you know, exhort, you know, all the hard work and the effort and the energy that they've poured into the growth that they've experienced. And then we also look out into the audience. Now, I know somewhere out here, there's some parents, you know, there's some teachers who've made a difference in the life of little AJ over here who we're honoring. Could you please stand up and be recognized? Can you come forward? Can we take a photo with you as well? And sometimes we reach out to the students. Hey, you are here because you have grown more than any other fifth graders in this district this last month in these areas. Come to the stage, come to the microphone. Do you want to share with us a little bit about what it is that's allowed you to really excel and grow so much? These students are not the students that most school boards are recognizing. Most school boards are recognizing the students who are associated with well-organized groups of adults. Often, I suspect that they're actually glorifying adults more so than glorifying children. Like if we really wanted to honor children, we'd probably do it in a place where children most want to be honored, which isn't at a school board meeting with a bunch of gray hairs. And so I question, what is the real intention behind when we're honoring students at a school board meeting? What I say it is, in our district, is we use the opportunity to build a culture to say that the adults who are going to get shine from this school board, the adults who will get to stand in the light, are the ones who are standing next to students who they have helped lift up into the light as well. You got to constantly not just tell the stories, every single month, refresh the stories, make it part of your monitoring. Lift up what's possible for children, lift up what children are growing and what they know and are able to do, where the school system is actually doing its job.
Yeah. Well, and in that you're elevating that student voice and their story in a way that is highlighting, I don't know. I just feel like even representation for those students to other students to see that work too, as well. It provides hope. And you're right, refreshing those stories, right? It's not just about reminding of that story, but continually having that in front. And that's really powerful work. AJ, this was a fantastic conversation. I'm sure we could talk about education things for a long time, but I wanted to just kind of like end something, you know, we like to have fun here at Branchy Minds. And so I always kind of like want to ask a little bit about like what for you, when you were going through school, what was something that unique to you that you found like most fun about school? And maybe there wasn't anything about the actual school, but like, is there a specific memory that you think that like you think back on and it is like, that was a fun part of school?
Well, the first thing that jumped to my mind right when you asked that question was I went to 11 different schools. So I bounced around quite a bit. And one of the things that was a little bit fun for me was that each year I felt a freedom to try out different things. And so I'd be involved in theater, you know, one year, and athletics another year, and chess club another year, and Model UN another year, and speech and debate another year. And just really each year feeling a sense of freedom to lean into what are the unique offerings this particular school provides. Things that I'm fairly confident had I just been, you know, kind of one or two or three schools all the way out, kind of the normal trajectory, the normal healthy path that we'd want for most of our children, that I suspect I might have tracked myself into whatever path seemed to work at that particular school rather than actually exploring all the other paths. But that freedom of just being a different, being the new kid every single year really, I think, gave me a sense of freedom to explore and learn more about myself and my interests than I would have otherwise.
That's really cool. I've talked to other guests and we talk about just the electives and how powerful those are for a student experience. And I'm as a former theater kid myself and musician, I am a big advocate for not really on stage, more behind the scenes. I did set design and directing and all that kind of stuff. I did a little, I went to a very small school. So of course I was on stage at some point because everybody was, but I just think that, those are the things sometimes that bring kids to school. They're the reasons kids show up every day is because of those things that they're interested in. And it's a great place to explore and take a risk too. I always encourage students to just try things out and see if you like them, So that's really great. Well, thank you so much for chatting today and talking more about your book and your experience. I'm sure there's so many other areas that you have expertise in and knowledge, but we just appreciate you sharing about restorative practices and school boards and yeah.
Great to be here. Your team has been a lot of fun to hang out with. And so I appreciate you all giving me a chance to play in this particular sandbox.
Thanks for listening to School and Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast to hear all our future episodes. As well, if you're enjoying our content, would you do us a favor and rate and review our podcast on iTunes? This helps others find our podcast and let us know how much you love what we're creating. Branching Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To learn more about us, check out our website, branchingminds.com, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn @branchingminds.